It's Tudor mania at the moment, with the much-awaited Mary, Queen of Scots film out now. With impeccable timing, my guest today on Radio Gorgeous, author Kate Hubbard, who works at the Royal Literary Fund, has brought out a book about another powerful, wealthy and creative Tudor woman. She outlived four of her husbands. She was a friend of Queen Elizabeth and spent years with Mary, Queen of Scots, as her soft jailer. They sewed together. And most importantly, she was an amateur architect and who just loved building and designing houses and their interiors. She is Bess of Hardwick, and the book is Devices and Desires, Bess of Hardwick and the Building of Elizabethan England. I think that's the longest title I've ever said. Hi, Kate. Well, warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
So firstly, can you tell us who Bess was and where did she come from?
Well, Bess was a Derbyshire girl. She was born in about 1521 or maybe 1522. And she was born into a family of Derbyshire gentry who were not particularly prosperous, who had a little estate at Hardwick, which is the site of her future house, Hardwick Hall. And so she grew up in a gentry family, and her prospects were not at all brilliant. She really was hoping probably just to find a local husband and get married. And in fact, that's how she started off her sort of marital career, by marrying a local boy, which was a brief and short-lived marriage because he died. And then she moved on, and she sort of rose through Tudor England, partly by marrying, by sort of well-chosen husbands. There were four in total.
That's clever.
Yes, it was clever. And sort of each one was rather grander and richer than the last. And she sort of forged a path away from, although not totally away from Derbyshire, because she ended up coming back to Derbyshire, but she went to court, and she met the Queen, and she knew all the powerful Elizabethan Tudor noblemen, Burley and Leicester and so on. And so she was a force in Tudor England.
We love it. And she's a woman. Hooray.
And she was a woman.
Now, was she educated in any way?
No, she wasn't educated. She'd have had very rudimentary education.
So she could read and
she
write.
Could read and write, and she kept accounts. She kept her own, she oversaw anyway her own household accounts. So she knew how to do that. She would have learnt to sew, as all women really would have learned to sew and embroider. So, but it was really not much beyond basic reading and writing. And she has a very striking sort of italic handwriting, which was only something you learnt if you were sort of an educated woman. So she almost certainly didn't, as a child, she wouldn't have learnt to write in italic handwriting. I mean, her mother didn't. And her sisters didn't. But later on, at some point, she sort of acquired this educated hand.
I suppose it's like learning how to speak without an accent.
Exactly. She sort of, although she probably kept her Derbyshire accent.
Because then accents weren't relevant.
No, not at all. So she'd have probably had, she'd have kept her sort of flat Derbyshire accent.
Wonderful. Yep. Now, could women in Elizabethan times be powerful? You know, because in certain times in history, women get power taken away from them. They're not allowed it. Was it a good time to be a woman?
Well, Bess had the example of the Queen. So I think having a Queen on the throne must have been some form of sort of inspiration. And although it was a sort of strictly patriarchal society in terms of sort of legally and financially, women certainly had a certain amount of power in the sort of domestic sphere, running households and running estates. And I think the interesting thing about being a woman in Tudor England was that as a widow, you were much more powerful than a wife. Mm. So you had many more rights than you had as a wife. I mean, as a wife, you were essentially sort of subordinate to your husband.
And owned by him.
Him. And you had, but as a widow, you had a certain amount of independence. You could borrow money, for example. You could lend money. You could write a will. You could buy land. All those things which you weren't able to do as a wife, and also as a widow, you had an inheritance which was known as a jointure, which was one third of your husband's income, or at least a third of the income from his estates, which you had for your lifetime. So
is that
widow,
like a dowager would be
kind of, yes. Yeah. So you had this kind of you had an income which was yours to do as you wished with, which I mean on your death it would then revert back to the heirs, the husband's heirs. But so as a widow, you did have a certain amount of independence, and so Bess kind of made the most of that.
So let's talk about her first husband. How old was she, and who was Robert Barley? He just sounds quite a normal man, really.
I think Robert Barley was probably quite unremarkable. He was very young. I mean, he was probably about 14 when they married.
What?
And she was about 20, so 21. So
how do we have sex?
Well, I think they didn't. I think that was one of the points about the marriage, was marriages were generally not consummated until you were 16. I mean, you could marry when you were younger, but marriages, you would have waited to consummate the marriage. So
that's decent, really.
Yes. I mean, she could have sort of ravished him, but I don't think she... I mean, certainly family law had it that it was an unconsummated marriage because of his youth. And anyway, he died. So they were married for kind of about a year, and then he died, who knows why. And so then she was left, you know, she was left a widow for the first time. And came from just another family of Derbyshire gentry, and he had a very small estate, and he left her with a very small amount of money. But nevertheless, you know, she had £26, I think it was.
How much was that like now?
Well, I just don't know. But it wasn't nothing, you know. It was
a few thousand.
Definitely a few thousand. Yeah. And you know, it was, but you weren't, you couldn't, it was in no way a fortune. It was very modest, but it was something. And so she had a little tiny bit of, you know.
And she had that little bit of window of independence.
She did, yeah.
So she married next was Sir William Cavendish, so she became a lady.
Yeah. She did.
Yeah.
And Sir William Cavendish was absolutely key to Bess's sort of changing fortunes. And he was... He had grown rich. He, like her, he was from the gentry. So he was not from a noble family. He came from a gentry background. And like many people in Tudor England, he sort of pulled himself out of the gentry and rose into the nobility. And he did this, like many other men did, was through the dissolution. He became very rich.
Of the monasteries.
Yeah. So he was one of the auditors who actually went round England, kind of, you know, basically dismantling the monasteries and taking all their, you know, all their
oil paintings,
yeah,
and
their
gold
fantastic,
and,
you know,
yeah,
things, and yeah, and
criminal, really.
Yes, yeah, it was. I mean, you know, the terrible destruction. Mm. But he became very rich on the proceeds, and also and inherited a very large, valuable property in Hertfordshire that had been a former monastery. So he was at court, and he served served Edward the Fourth and then Mary the First, and so he was
a lot older then?
He was about 12 years older, so he was a bit older, but not so hugely older. And I think they were sort of quite well suited. They were both full of, you know, ambition and energy and drive and determination.
And they're both from the same place, so
they
got
each
other.
They were sort of both the same place. Yeah. And they had, and he was the father of her six children. In fact, she had eight, but two died young. So, and they set themselves up, and they had a, you know, they lived a rather grand life in London, mixing with sort of court circles. And then he also was persuaded by Bess, or we don't know this, but it would have been an odd thing to do otherwise. He bought this big house and estate in Derbyshire, which was Chatsworth. So I feel that probably that was at Bess's instigation. And
of course, because why else would he want to
be
Derbyshire?
No, I mean, he came from Hertfordshire, you know, he was from the sort of, you know, he had no connection with Derbyshire. Mm. Mm. So they bought this estate, and they started building the Chatsworth, not the present day Chatsworth, but Elizabethan Chatsworth, which was pretty much the same size. I mean, a socking great house.
Wow, wow.
And then, he died, so, you know.
Again? So, would you know the ages of people for the deaths then?
Yes, he was in his 40s when he he was. I think he was about 40, or no, maybe he was about 51. But he, you know, he wasn't old. He died quite suddenly. I mean, had some mysterious sickness and for about a year, and then he died. And And so Bess was then, you know, in her 30s, and she was
still young and still very, young, very wealthy.
And six young children. Mm. And William Cavendish actually turned out to have been sort of siphoning off revenues from his court position. And so he'd been sort of hauled up before the courts and before he this before the
so he really it, was quite a
he was a sort of
crook
he was yeah. well maybe that's a mm. bit unfair but he mm. was a sort of you know he was a kind of wheeler dealer you know yeah. he had things going on the side and you know he was unscrupulous mm. And you know a lot of people were making money you know were kind of doing a little bit of discreet kind of you know siphoning off of revenues anyway but he had there was this debt of £5,000 which was a lot and
God, yeah.
so he was called on to
that's
repay
like
this.
Million
yes I mean yeah. you know and then he died and then Bess mm. sort of inherited this debt so she had a you know young children a big debt a big house in Derbyshire which was not finished and so it was a you know it was a sort of bad moment and I think also she kind of loved him. I think he
was
the husband.
Yes, I was going to say, was he the kind of love of her life?
If she loved any of her husbands, I think it was William Cavendish.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I think that was a terrible, you know, that was a big blow.
So what was her next move then?
Well, she got married again, which is really her only,
how
really,
long
her
gap
only
did
option.
She, how long gap did she have?
She had, I think it was about 3 years.
Okay, that's respectable.
Yes, respectable.
Yeah.
And she married a man called Sir William St. Low, who was also had a court position, and that's in fact probably where she'd come across him.
Definitely. Yeah. And well, she was looking for the right sort.
Yes, and she also was hanging about in London.
He was ultra wealthy, this
and
one,
he was
wasn't
very
he
yeah. was very wealthy, and he was yeah. socially sort of he was from an old sort of family of sort of aristocratic
well, that
family.
Surname
so he was
is
socially
fabulous.
He was grander yeah. than Cavendish, yeah. and he also had very large estates in Somerset in Gloucestershire, and he was a very you know, extremely devoted and doting husband. And
wow. What and so, did she have that we don't have?
Well, I know, it is a little, it's a bit mysterious because yeah. she doesn't always come across as, you know, terribly likeable because she was, but she was tough, you know, and her letters, you know, she make her, you know, are pretty kind of businesslike and not always, you know, not always terribly sympathetic. But I think she must have been attractive. I mean, she, you know, I think she had, I don't think she was a great beauty, but I think she had tremendous sort of charisma and energy and vitality.
And she was handsome, that's more than
yes.
good looking.
Yes, and she was probably fun, you know. I think
yeah.
she clearly had something, and because all her husbands actually were pretty devoted to her.
That's amazing.
And anyway, so William
maybe
St.
she
Lowe
dominated
was,
them a bit.
I think she did. I think she was a very good manager, you know. And I think some husbands just like
yeah,
being
they
managed.
They love it. They
you know,
love it.
She
I
was
mean,
an
that's...
excellent manager, and she ran a very tight ship. You know, the household, everything went very sort of.
So
know.
They didn't have to think. Really.
No,
they
she
would
took,
just come
she
home.
She took
and
care of things.
Her slippers were warm.
Yes,
sort of.
You know, she was very good at that.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so William St. Low, he paid her debt, and he paid for her children to go to, you know, the
good
sons
schools.
To go to Eton,
yeah.
and he funded, he coughed up for her to start building at Chatsworth again. And so, you know, he was really, you couldn't really fault him.
So was he the start of her building mania then?
Well, she'd started that with Cavendish, I think. And then, and it was very much, I think it was, I don't think it really came from William St. Leo. I think it was her own thing. And actually, I think there was a little bit of friction because she was very much wanting to be at Chatsworth in Derbyshire, getting on with her building, and William St. Low had to be at court with the Queen. So he was sort of tied to court, and he writes these rather sort of sad letters full of longing, saying, I wish you were with me and I miss you so much, and when are you coming to London? And she clearly really rather preferred just to stay put and get on with her own projects.
So the book is called The Building of Elizabethan England. Mm. What did she build then?
Well, so she built, Chatsworth was her first house. Mm-hmm. And then she went on and she built two houses at Hardwick, Hardwick Old Hall and Hardwick New Hall, which were literally
that's
next door
shocking,
to each
other. It's a bit shocking, isn't it? It's a bit shocking. I don't want, one's not enough. I want two.
Well, she built Hardwick Old Hall, which was when she was, this was a bit later on in her life when her fourth marriage was breaking down and she was very much in need of a home of her own. And she'd been sort of driven out of her other homes by her furious final fourth husband. So she sort of built the old hall when she was sort of feeling a bit desperate, I think. She just needed a big house. And it was all, it was very, very large and very grand inside and very lavishly furnished. But it was a bit of a mess architecturally. It didn't sort of make sense. And it was a bit sort of incoherent and a bit of a muddle. And I think she just thought it wasn't the house she wanted. You know, she wanted to build the perfect house.
I suppose, again, if she's into order and structure, yes. Then she sort of architecture is the ultimate control, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. And I think, so she sort of put it aside and carried on. It was still in use. And then, but it wasn't even finished when she started building Hardwick New Hall, which was literally 100 yards away.
And Hardwick, which is the Hardwick that's still around now?
So that's Hardwick New Hall, okay. Which is the Hardwick Hall, more glass and wall.
That and what's Hardwick. Amazing is it's the public, we can see it, but also you say it's hardly changed.
No, it's hardly changed, and its interiors have hardly... I mean, it's unusual in Elizabethan houses because the interiors are pretty much the same. The way, you know, nothing much has been sort of messed about with. And I mean, a lot of the furniture and the plate, which was all Tudor houses were full of gold and silver plate. They'd been
what, on the walls
and everywhere. I mean, sort of, I say plate, I mean sort of, you know, huge ewers and bowls and cups and, you know, spoons.
So sparkling.
And, so it would have sparkle, you know, and that was... And
yes, because windows were the new thing.
And windows were
so
new.
Light,
also,
so light. You wanted to, if you had windows, you wanted to show off, didn't you? That you owned things that glistened.
Yes. But so a lot has been lost at Hardwick in terms of sort of furnishings, but the actual sort of interiors themselves are pretty much the same. And a lot of the amazing textiles and hangings that Bess either kind of worked on and produced herself or bought because she loved textiles are all still there, and they're really, really extraordinary.
Isn't it one of the largest collections?
Yes, I think in England, actually. Of Elizabethan textiles. And there are sort of amazing, well, embroideries and also these kind of, like, it's sort of applique, which is a bit like sort of patchwork of sort of using velvets and silks and a lot of them cut from old church vestments. And
yes,
and there are these beautiful things that are still, you know, their colours are still almost as they were, you know, as
fantastic
bright as they were.
It's been saved.
Yeah.
So why wasn't it messed up, this house?
Well, it was mostly not messed up because of Chatsworth. And because Chatsworth became the kind of primary home of the Devonshires. I mean, through Bess and William Cavendish, their direct descendants are the present Duke of Devonshire of today. And they made Chatsworth their primary house because it was sort of bigger, really. And
better location?
And not really better location, but just bigger. Mm. And so it was the Bess's Chatsworth was knocked down in the 17th century and they built another enormous house. But from that point, you know, that was the sort of Devonshire seat. And so Hardwick became a sort of secondary house.
Sort of on the estate.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so they would go and spend, you know, a few weeks there, a year.
Yeah, like hunting lodge
style. So it was sort of, so it was sort of allowed just to kind of just, it was sort of left because no one was really that interested in it. So it was sort of, if it had been their primary residence, they'd almost certainly have knocked it down and built something much more kind of fashionable, which is what happened at Chatsworth. But they didn't do that because no one really was bothered about it. It could just sit there.
And I read a thing about her crest. Can you tell us about that and how she used it? And it was, again, the fashion, wasn't it?
Do you mean her initials?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's the most noticeable thing. If you go to Hardwick Hall today, you look up and you see all across along the parapet, there are these giant ESs, Elizabeth Shrewsbury. I mean, carved in stone, very big. And it is just a rather extraordinary thing just to build this house. And she was nearly 70 when she started work on it, and it took about 7 years. And then just to sort of cover it with your initials. And if you go inside the house, you know, there are ESs absolutely everywhere. Every single overmantel over every fireplace has an ES, and the ESs are embroidered into every single piece of tapestry and textile.
Now, do you think that was the fashion, or was that her personal statement?
Well, I think it was... There were houses that were sort of... I don't actually know of any other house in Elizabethan England that literally had the initials of the builder kind of, you know, sort of plastered all over it, like Hardwick. Mm. I mean, there were some houses that were built in the shape of a letter.
E. Yeah.
Yes, because, yeah. And because you know, Elizabethans like those sort of puzzles and
yes.
and sort of hidden meanings and, you know, acrostic verse. And But actually, I think Bess, I think it was just, you know, I think it was a sort of, Hardwick was about her. It was a celebration of a woman, of her identity, and she wanted to make that plain. And so I think it was unusual. I mean, I think it was unusual then, and I think it was, you know, it would be surprising now.
Yeah, she's an extraordinary woman. So tell us about needlework. So every woman would do it, and you would probably kind of in the day, you probably, I don't know, go for a ride, go for a walk, then you'd spend the rest of the day probably sewing, would you?
Yes. And I mean, I think it was something that, you know, the lady of the house would do with her, sort of with her gentlewomen, or if she was a bit less grand, just with her servants. And, you know, Bess had a sort of various kind of gentlewomen who kind of sort of were sort of upper servants rather than lower servants.
Kind of
more like companions. And they
she'd
would
probably
sit together.
Gossip and chat.
Yes, and they'd sit together and sew, and they'd sew all sorts of things, just from, you know, embroidered pillowcases to sort of great textiles that would hang on the wall. And but actually, they also the most complicated techniques in embroidery were undertaken by men, but not women. So
sewing gold and things.
Yes, doing embroidery using metal thread, gold and silver metal thread.
That's horrible to use.
So
I
probably
imagine.
Actually, it's really
you probably have to wear
hard,
leather gloves
yes,
and things.
Sort of, yeah. You know, spiky and difficult. And and so throughout her life, actually, Bess had a sort of resident embroiderer who was always a man. Who was on the hard stuff. Yes, who was a kind of permanent member of the household.
I love it.
Yeah.
Embroidery to the house. So do you think they were taught from young age, you know?
I think so. It's sort of very hard to know. I think it was something that you would have done probably from a child and sort of, I don't know, improved, you know, your technique
along the
way.
So have you ever tried doing embroidery yourself?
No, I'm absolutely
Kate.
Terrible. I'd love to be able to do embroidery, but I'm too impatient and I sort of just get cross.
See, I remember my mother used to do it, and I used to kind of, we'd all have a go at it, you know, everyone in the family, and I always thought it looked really relaxing, actually.
Yes, I've never found that.
But I think I'd be like, I get it knotted, or I couldn't tie it, or I got the colours wrong, or, you know.
Yeah.
I'm quite clumsy.
Yeah, no, me too.
Such a shame.
Yes.
So she's got this brilliant collection. Can you tell us about her relationship with Queen Elizabeth I? What you know?
Yes. I mean, she knew Elizabeth, you know, right from early on. She knew Elizabeth from when Elizabeth was... She was about 10 years older than Elizabeth. But she met Elizabeth when Elizabeth was a teenager and a princess and hadn't actually acceded to the throne. And she made... And she and William Cavendish made Elizabeth kind of godmother to their eldest son.
That was
Henry.
Clever.
Yeah. So they had a sort of long association, and, you know, they were not completely dissimilar. You know, they both had a certain sort of feisty, you know.
Both redheads.
Mm. You know, they both sort of took on the sort of man's world, really, in their slightly different ways. And they were sort of. I think there's a certain sort of wariness. I mean, I don't think they were friends, because I don't think she was, you know, I don't think Elizabeth had friends, or certainly not sort of women. You know, I think she was
the
queen.
Have intimates.
I think the queen. No,
yeah.
not. Mm. But they definitely had a sort of. They were on sort of cordial, friendly terms, and she would, you know, there's some letters exchanged between them.
What about?
Usually about fairly. Mundane things, saying, you know, thank you for, you know, being at court, and
thank you letters,
or thank you letters, or for, you know, or best, slightly sort of asking for favours. And
so did Elizabeth stay with her at Chatsworth?
No, she never did. And I think Bess, I think, certainly hoped that Elizabeth would visit Hardwick, because she kind of created the grandest room, which is called the High Great Chamber. Is a sort of has a lot of sort of elaborate kind of tributes to Elizabeth in the plasterwork.
Oh, so that was it. She was.
So I think she was angling. She was hoping it would be to get a visit from Elizabeth, and but actually, Elizabeth never came. And in fact, when she went on her sort of these progresses she'd do in the summer, she tended to not go as far north as
I was going to say.
Derbyshire was you know, a week on horseback from. London, so she tended to trundle round the closer to London, and so she sort of never
Kent and Sussex and
and Hertfordshire and Berkshire and Northamptonshire and so on, but not quite as far as Derbyshire, And actually, the other thing, Bess was very good about giving good presents to the Queen, which the Queen was very keen on sort of generous gifts. And at New Year, Elizabethans gave presents, not at Christmas, but at New Year. And so a lot of, you know, if you were sensible, you really thought about what you were going to give the Queen, who very much expected a New Year's present every New Year. And she was particularly keen on clothes. A lot of people just gave money, which was sort of perfectly acceptable. But she liked a really good frock.
Yeah.
And so Bess would spend quite a lot of time. There was, you know, letters sort of consulting people about how the frock should be and what it should look like.
So can you describe a frock, do you think? Yeah.
Well, there was a frock that was kind of embroidered with pansies, because that was meant to be one of the Queen's favourite flowers, and so she was advised that pansies would be amazing.
Good. Purple and black and yellow.
Yes, so probably purple and gold. And,
yeah, very loud,
and then there
actually.
And was a cloak that was, I think, a sort of travelling cloak that was kind of made of watchet, which was kind of pale blue satin and lined with some sort of pinkish velvet. Oh, so
I adore it.
Yeah.
I want to wear it. I mean, that really is a cloak for a princess, yes, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. Gorgeous colours.
Yeah.
And lovely with her white skin and red hair as well. Yeah, so we've said that she's got red hair and she looks quite tall. I mean, you can't really tell by the pictures.
I think she wasn't very tall. I mean, from her, she was buried in Derby Cathedral and there's a sort of effigy. And if that does, you know, if that is Bez, you know, in relation to her size, she was probably actually only about 5 foot, which was pretty average. You know, then, I mean, everyone was tiny, really. So I think she wasn't, I think she was sort of quite slight, and I think she, you know, I think she probably had a lot of presence, but I think she wasn't particularly tall.
Well, we all know people like Madonna, you know, Kylie, smaller women do like power, actually. They often goes together.
Yes, yes.
Tell me about, one of the things you use the word vitality quite a lot, because she did have good health, which in those days was everything, wasn't it?
Yes. No, she was remarkable. I mean, she lived, you know, she was 87 when she died. She died in 1608, which was extraordinary. And she'd sort of outlived, you know, practically everyone. She'd outlived the Queen, who was 10 years younger, and she'd outlived all her contemporaries and friends, like, you know, Lord Burghley and the Earl of Leicester. And of course, you know, she'd outlived all her husbands.
I mean, that was like living till 110.
Yes. Then. Yes, yes. And she's, you know, and there's hardly any, there's no mention, she'd occasionally sort of write a letter complaining of having a headache and she suffered from some sort of rheumatism. I mean, if you lived in some freezing, damp houses, everyone had rheumatism and arthritis. And so she sort of would complain about that a bit. And in the end, she became very sort of stiff and her knees kind of seemed to have sort of collapsed. But, I mean, I think she just simply, you know, until really the last year of her life, she was still absolutely carrying on. And
what about her diet? Because there's a lot of descriptions of barrels of fish and all these extraordinary things.
Well, she had, they had an amazingly sort of varied diet, really, Elizabethans. And you can tell a lot by what she ate, because all the household accounts are still in existence and you can look at them and read them. And so you can see exactly what they were buying and eating. And so they had a huge variety of not just the sort of normal meats that you'd expect, you know, venison, beef and rabbit and chickens and so on, but also they ate huge amounts of fish and very varied fish.
In Derbyshire, how does fish get to Derbyshire? Well, do you think it was salted?
I think some of it was salted, and they definitely had visiting fishmongers who would come regularly, you know, twice a week, who probably were bringing fish from, possibly from the coast.
Yeah, I'm trying to think where the coast would be. Norfolk, Hull?
Hull, I think.
Yeah, well, actually Hull, it's a massive fishing area. Yeah.
And they ate a lot of oysters and shrimps and, you know, crab.
And they had barrels of it.
Barrels of it, and some of it was sturgeon and some of it was salted. And then all sorts of amazing, you know, a lot of fruit and cherries and pomegranates and things, which was also imported, obviously, things like pomegranates. So there was a very sort of healthy trade with the Far East. So she got all sorts of exotic spices and fruits.
Because they didn't have sugar there, so what did they use for sweeteners?
Well, they would get, you could buy these, they were called sugar loaves, and they were imported, and it would come in a kind of like a block of sugar. It was expensive, which then you would sort of chip away.
So like a giant sugar cube.
Exactly, yeah, like a giant sugar cube.
So that would be so kind of exceptional to be able to afford that, wouldn't it?
Yes, and they had very sweet teeth. I mean, I think that was probably the one thing that I'm sure she didn't have good, I mean, you couldn't have had good teeth. She probably had no teeth by the time she was 87. And because they had a very, Elizabethans had an extremely sweet tooth. They ate these kind of comfits, which they were called, which were sort of like sweets that you'd have at the end of your meal.
Was that like dried fruit kind of?
It was more like sort of jelly, more like sort of jellies, sort of sugary jellies. And but sort of, I think, extremely sweet, and then they'd be flavoured with things
like
caraway seeds and a bit like those glacé fruits.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Very sweet.
God, I think they sound absolutely delicious.
Well, and delicious.
So let's go on to her fourth and final marriage now.
Yes.
Who did she marry?
So her final husband was the grandest of them all.
And, hooray!
He was an earl, and he was the Earl of Shrewsbury. And he was a kind of great sort of, he was like a sort of Midlands tycoon, really. He had many houses in the Midlands and also in London. And he was immensely rich, and he had huge estates. And
he inherited this?
Yes. So the Shrewsbury, it was an ancient family, and he was one of the sort of greats of northern earls, really. And so she then became a countess. And so it was sort of that, you know, she didn't really need another husband. You know, she was, when the third husband, William St. Lowe, died, she was left very wealthy.
In fact, I read in the book, it said she was the wealthiest woman in Britain.
She was, next to the Queen, after the Queen.
That's incredible.
But so she sort of didn't really need to marry again the fourth time, but I think she couldn't quite resist, you know, he was an earl and you know, so that sort of took her into a different sort of sphere. And she ended up also, she married two of her children to two of his children. So
now
it was
clever.
Which was clever because it meant that actually the Shrewsbury lands wouldn't be lost. You know, they would, her own children would benefit from them. And so it was like a sort of, it was a sort of merger, I think, their marriage. You know, it was they were kind of merging their assets. But it was initially, I think, a very, you know, was happy and contented. And he was certainly very, you know, loving, or at least sounds very loving in his letters to her. And she was, it seemed affectionate.
How old was she when she married him the last time?
So she was then she was about 44.
Okay.
And he was a little bit younger.
They're still having sex, probably.
But I guess, you know, then it was, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem that old to us now, but then I think you were sort of getting on in your 40s. But they were, you know, they weren't old, and it was so the first few years, I think, it was rather, you know, successful marriage, and then, but it did go very, it broke down in quite a spectacular bitter way.
Oh, tell us.
Well, it was partly to do with Mary Queen of Scots, who in 1569 the Earl of Shrewsbury was made Mary Queen of Scots jailer by Queen Elizabeth, largely because they didn't really know what Elizabeth, no one knew what to do with Mary.
I suppose they thought if we send her to a nice house, she can't go anywhere, but at least it's sort of, she's got pleasant surroundings.
Yes, yeah. They basically wanted her sort of contained and not causing trouble. And Shrewsbury had all these houses in the Midlands, which were, geographically, it was good because the Midlands were a long way from London, from Scotland, from English ports. So it was sort of geographically quite a safe place for Mary. And he had these quite grand houses, and, you know, Mary had a large entourage, you know, up to sort of 60 people. So it wasn't, you know, not everyone would have been able to kind of accommodate her, but he could. And he was actually, as it turned out, expected to sort of pay the bills for keeping her.
Very expensive.
And it was very expensive. And it became a tremendous strain, really, because he was her, you know, jailer for 15 years. And he was completely tied. It sort of ruined his life, and it pretty much kind of ruined his marriage in the end. And
why did it ruin his life? In what way?
Because he was completely sort of tied to Mary. He couldn't leave, you know, he couldn't wherever.
He had no freedom.
He had no freedom. He couldn't come to London, you know, he couldn't go and visit. He wasn't supposed to have his children, weren't meant to come visit because that was seen as a sort of security risk.
Oh.
And he was constantly
being... So he was kind of jailed in a way.
Yes, exactly. He was as much a prisoner of her as she was.
And he did
him.
It, I suppose, to please Queen Elizabeth.
Yes, and he thought it was... He was a very sort of dutiful man, Shrewsbury. And I think he thought it was... initially, I think it was a sort of honour that he was trusted with this task. But it wasn't long before, you know, he was complaining bitterly and sort of longing to be rid of her. but the Queen wasn't having it. So he was stuck with her. And Bess grew increasingly sort of fed up and exasperated by Mary, although initially they got on rather well and did a lot of sewing together, because Mary was a very kind of accomplished needlewoman. But then Bess, after a while, she just really, you know, she just took herself off to another house, mostly actually to Chatsworth, and carried on. She was still carrying on with her building.
So they kind of lived apart.
She spent less and less time with Shrewsbury and with Mary. And then there were various rumours that actually Mary was having a love affair with Shrewsbury, and that they'd had a child together. And
I wouldn't be surprised, because, you know, two people on their own locked together.
Mary was very attractive, you know, and she was young. She was 15 years younger than Bess. So, and she was famously kind of beautiful and
very educated. Very educated.
Yes, and manipulative. Yeah. And men found her kind of, you know, extremely alluring. And
do you think she had a French accent or an English accent or?
I think she didn't have a Scottish. I mean, she'd grown up in the French court, from the age of five. So
French.
I think she probably had a French accent. And
so she was sophisticated.
And beautiful and actually very tall in those days. Oh. She was nearly 6 foot, which was very unusual.
Gosh.
And very elegant and so anyway, Shrewsbury sort of drove him mad, and he became really slightly unhinged. And it was, you know, he had a kind of nervous breakdown looking after Mary. And then became increasingly sort of paranoid and convinced that Bess and her children were just sort of trying to extract money from him endlessly, which, I mean, there was some truth in that. I mean, Bess was always asking for money. And so in the end, he just felt increasingly sort of embittered that he was just, you know, seen as a provider of, you know,
like most husbands.
Yes. And that he was being taken advantage
exactly,
of.
Exactly. So how did it end then?
Well, it ended actually, they basically separated, and it was, although there was a lot of efforts to bring them back together, and the Queen stepped in and tried to sort of, you know, bring about a reconciliation, but that didn't work, and they ended up living separately. And Shrewsbury actually had, in the end, his housekeeper was his mistress. So he sort of set up in one of his many houses. And Bess went and built herself.
So they never divorced?
They never divorced. Mm. And Bess started work on building her house at Hardwick, the old hall. And they did, you know, they were completely separated. And then he died in 1590, Shrewsbury died. And then she was free, really, and rich and very rich. And then she went on and built her last, actually not her last house, her third house, which was the New Hall at Hardwick.
And we can go and see it because it's National Trust.
It's National Trust, and it's, if you're driving along the M1 and going north, you can see it if you just look up when you're about 20 miles past Nottingham, and it sort of now looks down onto the M1. But it's worth a visit.
What did you feel when you walked in there?
Well, I was just, you know, I was very astonished by the fact that there were, by her initials, giant initials, sort of all across the rooftop. And I was, you know, I was, it's a kind of quite a modern house in some ways. It's quite austere and restrained and it's a kind of quite a simple but rather ingenious design. It's got a very beautiful staircase that leads you, stone staircase leading through it. And also I was rather amazed at the fact that she built it, you know, in her 70s. So she didn't, that to me was interesting, you know, that she would embark on this at that point in her life. And it's a very, it is, I think it's a very kind of remarkable house.
And she was a remarkable woman. And thank you so much for your remarkable woman to know so much about her. I'm really impressed. But I'm really am. I've said to my husband, I'm desperate to go to Chatsworth and I'm going to go to Hardwick that weekend as
yes,
well.
Yes, you should.
It'll be absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. It's been a real treat today.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me too. Thank you.
So Bess of Hardwick is, and the building Elizabethan England is published by Chatto & Windus.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can always find extraordinary women on Radio Gorgeous.